As I was, I would always advise in interviews, you sort of follow the thread in interviews, as you follow the thread, follow the conversation, sort of where it leads, right?
Yeah,
that's when you get the best stuff.
Absolutely. Okay. Cool. But yeah, to your point, I don't know if I can make any claims about the quality of my Twitter output unto itself, but thematically speaking, I agree with that with you as far as. I guess maybe I could say that I would characterize a lot of my past critiques of the user experience design and product world as being more critical and less alternative focused than I would usually like, or less productive maybe than I would prefer. And it's just been recently that I've realized that the missing piece that I have been kind of banging my head against and trying to call attention to, rather than framing it as shortcomings of the current processes in place, I think just really focusing on putting a term to user value and trying to pull people's attention toward actually providing real value in reality is at least a worthy thing to consider. So that's I guess to whatever extent that's been valuable for you, I'm glad. But yeah, other than that, I would happily field whatever your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting I've sort of seen you're getting some heated at times debates with other folks. I know Jared Spohr has been a particular combatant, maybe that's the actual word, but there has been some good pushbacks and good discussion around these topics. But I think it's sort of wrapping, sort of encapsulates a lot of things that are going on in the sort of UX and products worlds around, should designers code? Should designers learn business? Should they, like, what is actually the role of design in building products, right? And then what is the result of a designer in building products? And it's interesting that in my mind, I think you're sort of more recent, so you've been very succinct about it recently, right? The idea, like, don't hack growth, hack user value. Software is not inherently valuable, right? Like, software with the great UX is not necessarily valuable, right? These are just, I'm just quoting your tweets, which I would love to hear sort of how you got to those sort of succinct thoughts. And I'm just curious in general, sort of what does your work look like day to day? Because you have sort of some, I would say pretty different views than maybe a lot of UX designers, or I don't even know if that's a term that you would necessarily associate yourself with.
Yeah, well, I am very into that whole cluster of questions. I'll try to answer it as linearly as I can. I guess maybe biographically would make sense. I have a background in user experience design over the last decade plus. That's the capacity in which I was working in-house at agencies, software companies, etc., as well as consulting and contracting and things along those lines, freelancing. And when I started User Onboard about 5 years ago, that led to a really big influx in professional opportunities and people coming and saying, like, hey, we like how you make fun of these other people's products, and we want you to do that for us, but don't make fun of it as much and don't publish it. And I was like, oh, there's like a business here. And so from a consulting standpoint, I've had all the incentives in the world to really focus specifically on user onboarding, or at least the user onboarding part of the overall user experience of a product. And in doing so, it's just led to some questions to wrestle with that I think that people who don't focus so relentlessly on one particular aspect of the experience would never really begin to question or need to explore. And in my particular case, I've just been constantly asked from strangers or clients or anywhere in between like, you know, do you, we're thinking about adding a tooltip tour. Do you think that that would be better than an introductory video? Or I've heard good things about in-app messaging. Like what product should I use to add that to my product? Or different questions that are very surface level design pattern kind of level of abstraction. Whereas to me, the really relevant question has always been not so much how do you show people your product or how do you like inspire astonishment at the different things that someone can do, but how do you actually help them do that? And presumably, how do you identify what they're even supposed to be doing or want to be doing to begin with that you could even be helping them with, period? And so for me, the process of trying to figure out what good onboarding versus bad onboarding is has really never been a question of like, do you use tooltips or do you use hotspots or things along those lines? But like, what if you're almost thinking of it as like a scripted interaction that your product or service has with the user who's signing up for it, what do you want that activity to consist of? And how do you go about generating that activity? And for me, the activity really has to start within the context of what the user is wanting to do and trying to do, rather than what you want the user to do, because you're always going to lose that fight. And so when I would in the past look at successful onboarding, I would say that it would be empirically demonstrated through conversion numbers, like, you know, certainly activations or just regular, you know, old engagement, or certainly something like retention, very kind of in the realm of what a growth team would really pay attention to. But even then, those are all indications of activity that are very company centric, even though the user is generating them, rather than centered around what the user is trying to do and just finding creative ways for the company to benefit by providing a better way of doing those. That was quite a lengthy answer, so I don't know if that covered everything, but that's the kind of gist of it.
Yeah, that totally sort of resonates with me, and I think this is something that became clear to me as I started to get more into sort of jobs to be done and the idea of, you know, desired outcomes and the progress that the people are trying to make. And once you start realizing that that progress actually has nothing to do with your product, right? Your product is just a vehicle to get people from where they currently are to that progress. It's really a mindset shift. From you say, the sort of, well, if I complete this onboarding checklist, then that tells me these are the things I need to click in the product. One thing that I'm curious about is sort of knowing what you know now, and, you know, you've been doing this a while, like you said, I've been sort of gone deeper, I would say, than, you know, just about anybody in this topic. Has that changed how you think about defining the sort of the metrics, and like, how do you think about defining success? Because I mean, product teams and sort of companies in general are always going to want to measure things, right? That's sort of how you have to set a bar for something. How do you think about defining those, like what success looks like in the product?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and just to be clear, I am pro measurement. I would be relieved to see the design community embracing measurement more. And I think that certainly, you know, kind of like what you were mentioning previously, that the design community kind of has its like pet arguments about whether they should code or not, or the term seat at the table gets thrown around all the time. And right. Personally, I think that businesses would do well by incorporating design more into their high-level strategic decision-making. But at the same time, I don't think that you can use the same design practices that were developed outside of the table within the context of the hypothetical table itself. And so there are a lot of ways to identify what the business impact of design changes are that are really just kind of sitting out there right now that nobody's really paying a lot of attention to. What I have found is that either companies focus on design as this sort of loose concept of like almost like humanitarian values that they carry within their organization. And, you know, that's sort of the school of user experience design that's focused on to, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, things like personas and user journeys and scenarios and things like that, where I think the point is kind of to like inculcate this sort of appreciation of the user's perspective into the decisions that get made, but without necessarily having a really strong way to tie those decisions to the actual impact that they have on the user base themselves. Or alternatively, you have giant corporations like Facebook or, you know, corporate level software service at scale that is incredibly numbers focused around things like hopefully user retention and user engagement, but can also very quickly blur the lines between what's necessarily good for a user versus what's good for that person as a cog in the overall system, or what the p-value, or not p-value, but what is it, k-value or whatever, like what, you know, how much viral worthiness that someone has, or how much ad revenue they're generating by being sucked in with their attention or things like that. And so I think that there's a really viable middle ground between those two, where you can identify goals that are centered around or aligned with what your users' goals are. And once you have aligned your incentives, track your mutual progress in that regard. So all of that's a long-winded way of, you know, if your question specifically is like, what are the numbers that you look at for user success and how has my appreciation for that changed over the years? I would definitely say I skew away from any of like the normal kind of funnel type metrics like acquisition, activation, revenue, referral, etc. Those are all very company centric. And I think that you want to keep an eye on those, but I don't think you want to design for them. You want to design for assisting people in whatever context of progress they're bringing your product into, and to ideally make your product or service as self-aware as possible within those, so that I can even identify what the change that somebody's looking to make is before it can even align itself around helping someone achieve that. And when you pay attention to what people are actually doing with your product, then the activities that they are engaging in are inherently very measurable, because that's all just user activity that's being saved to the database in a way. Like, your product knows what your users have been doing. Why doesn't your reporting know that?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring up. You sort of, you know, brought up my next question, which was going to be around this idea of context and understanding, you know, the specific context which a user or a customer, whatever term you want to use. Good debate about that too. So understanding the context which your user is bringing with them and the context in which they are trying to achieve their goals, how do you go about, so you mentioned sort of ideally the product is able to do that in sort of a, you know, whether it's a self-learning or sort of adaptive way. And I know I've heard you on in other interviews talking about, you know, ideally onboarding is adaptive to those needs. Ideally the product experience is adaptive, sort of all aligned with this goal of success for that particular person. But how do you go about identifying that context? I guess both sort of once somebody has already signed up and is sort of inside of your product experience, but how do you sort of initially think about designing for that context and understanding that context enough to be able to design for it?
Yeah, well, that's $1 million question for sure. I would say, you know, most of my experience is working with companies who already have a product and already have a user base. And usually, you know, my contributions are try to provide an alternative perspective of what they could be focusing on instead. But either way, the nature of that challenge is very different than coming up with a thing to focus on to begin with from scratch, in the sense of like starting a whole new product. So in the sense of if you already have a product that has people organically signing up for it, let's say, and you were to bring me in to look at the onboarding experience, part of that experience, the things that I would be paying attention to are, can we identify through qualitative research and also some quantitative research what is even just on people's minds when they're signing up for the product? Is it because, you know, I'm trying to think of like any example product just to use here, but like, it is, it may be for some reason, we work at Airbnb and for some totally unexpected reason, it turns out that a lot of people are renting Airbnb places to celebrate their anniversary, let's say. I don't think that that is probably very likely at all, but let's just say there was some sort of insight we gained from the user research that was non-obvious, which is hopefully what you get from research, right? So, so like, let's say that we found out that a lot of people were signing up within the context of wanting to celebrate their anniversary. That to me would be a meaty thing to design around. It's not just how do we get more people to book places to stay, or how do we conversion rate optimize our check-in funnel or things along those lines. Although I think that would certainly be worthwhile too. But really specifically, like, how do we situate this whole service within the context of what someone's trying to do in a way that lets them know that what they care about is something that they are making progress on in a jobs to be done sort of way, or Kathy Sierra has certainly been a major influence in my thinking in this regard as well, with her notion of the idea that your software gives people superpowers or capabilities. If you think of the onboarding as somebody going through the process of attaining those superpowers, you'd have to wonder, like, why do you want to fly, or why do you want to be invisible, or what is the thing that you're trying to do with the invisibility that you're acquiring from us? And the more that the product itself can read the room, so to speak, while it's being used, I think only good things can happen for both the user and for the company, generally speaking.
Yeah, I love that that concept of sort of the, you know, what are you going to use? I love that. I don't know what it is, but that example of giving users superpowers. But the idea that if you have a cape and you can fly, like, you may just want to wear the cape. You probably don't want to just have the cape, right? You want to use the cape, right? You want to you want to be able to fly. And I think that is, if people ask that question more often, I think they would have, you know, greater success in identifying the you know, the end goal and ultimately build, you know, more valuable experiences. One thing that I'm really curious to sort of dig into, which is certainly related to this, is the difference between usable and valuable. And the idea that, which I guess is sort of tied to this idea of sort of what's the goal of user experience design, right? But it seems to me that those two are not necessarily the same thing, because you know, usability doesn't necessarily include this additional variable, which is context, right? Specific user context, which is that how you think about the difference between those two? Do you think there's a difference there? Sort of, how do you think about those two things?
How do I distinguish between the concepts of usability, of usable versus valuable?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I don't see those as really being conflicting concepts. I would say that making something usable, I mean, I guess maybe the alternative term I would throw in there would be usable versus useful, where you're not only identifying ways that someone can perform an activity or engage with a particular interface or things along those lines, but actually you're looking to troubleshoot the occurrence rate of that, where if you think of your product, I mean, I'll just keep trying to kind of ground this in onboarding terms, since that's where I have most of my expertise, but I guess it could go for any user interaction really. But, or as you said, what even is not onboarding, if onboarding is helping people become successful. I think that a lot of times when people are looking for help with their onboarding, they're thinking in terms of, we have a product, like there's some sort of conceptual object of product that they are looking to attach an on-ramp onto that kind of like hints at the value that it can provide and gives a tour of what it can do, but doesn't actually focus on trying to generate that activity itself per se. Does that distinction make sense at all?
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. And this is something that I would be remiss if, you know, we went the whole time here and I didn't ask you onboarding specific questions. Trying to bring it back to with examples from onboarding, but like it seems that people have very very different or very sort of widely variant definitions of onboarding. I'm curious how you think about it in the context of sort of both the work that you do, but also the work that you would advise. You know, I'm assuming like as a consultant, you're sort of coming in for, like you say, for a business that is trying to solve a specific problem, right? Maybe a specific bottleneck, maybe they're trying to improve a specific number. How would you advise teams to sort of think about onboarding? A, how would you define it to them? And B, how would you advise that they think about it on an ongoing basis?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I suppose that's sort of the segue I was looking to tee up, not as far as the onboarding part, but to draw a distinction sort of between what I don't recommend versus what I do recommend. Almost paradigm sort of level, would encourage people not to think of their software as a product, period. Because it does lead you to questions like, well, what is a good introduction to a product? Like, what should our onboarding on-ramp experience be? What kind of feature tour should we put into it? And I think those are all understandable questions when you are operating within that paradigm, but I don't think that those are useful for any of the top line business level outcomes that your company is looking to generate. I think that what you really want to focus on is thinking of, I mean, because ultimately, all right, let me see if this works. I don't know if I might be getting too abstract here, but in economics, which I will certainly not claim to have any expertise in, there's the concept of goods versus services, right? Where in the goods section, you are creating, you're manufacturing objects, tangible objects for sale. Whereas services is kind of more inherently nebulous or more outcome focused rather than material focused. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, I'm gonna throw out an example and maybe you can tell me if this is sort of along the lines you're thinking. We talked earlier about sort of, you know, the seat of the table discussion and making sure that you're measuring things that are actually aligned with user value. That like one way that I think about this is that is a metric that you would present to, present at that hypothetical table, number of guided tour video views,
right?
Or is a metric that you would present, you know, number of key actions completed, whatever that key action is, whether it's, you know, uploaded files, created tasks, hopefully completed tasks, right? Which is probably a better outcome than just creating them in the software, but
right.
Like, it's just sort of a means to an end, right? It's not actually the thing itself.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, let me try to tie everything together and wind up there as quickly as I can. So the idea of sort of distinguishing between goods and services, or thinking of your product as a product is more like thinking of your product as a good than it is like thinking of your product as a service. Whereas I would say it's much healthier to think of your product less as a good and more like it's a value delivery system, that you have this intangible non-stateful, I don't know what the best way to describe it would be, but you just have this code that's sitting on a server that doesn't really exist in any genuine capacity outside of when an actual user is actually requesting it onto an actual device and actually looking at it and engaging with it. And the idea of like designing a product as if it were some sort of hypothetical object, or if it as if it had some sort of material cohesion to it. I think it's fine. And I think it could help with usability if people are memorizing like how to navigate around it. But I think it just leads you to asking all sorts of the wrong questions as a designer of a cohesive object rather than a designer of outcomes for a user or for your user base or for people in general. And so going back to your most recent question, as far as having that seat at the table and deciding which numbers to focus on, I would strongly encourage all of my fellow table mates to pay as little attention as possible to something like how many intro videos were watched. That's something if you want to optimize for that outcome, I don't think it would be very likely that you could build a really reliable and sustainable business around it at the very least. Like, I'll just put that out there. And so what I like to focus on instead is saying, what is an outcome that's good for the company? What is a user activity that generates value for the company? Let's start there. Like, we don't have to be Mother Teresa's totally selfless and just be, you know, bending over backwards for the users all the time. Of course, we want it to be a mutual exchange. And so we can even start with what's most important to us. And so, you know, literally when I work with companies, like let's say that there's a company that does invoice management and that they have a 14-day trial. What I would immediately focus on as far as the sort of decision-making context of how to not only change the onboarding, but what you want the onboarding to, what the definition of performance for onboarding there even is, would be essentially what you want to do is convert brand new signups into people who have just upgraded out of their trial. And if you think of that the space in between those two states of existence, less as a tour that someone should take and then just hope for the best, and more as creating a whole system of transformation from one state to the other, the questions become a lot more interesting, at least to me. So if you're sitting at the table and saying, how many intro videos did you watch or have we generated? I wouldn't assume that that was valuable, and I wouldn't assume that that was a major contribution to someone becoming successful, unless if I could see that cascading number further down in how that particular activity made it more likely that someone, if they have done that, would then go on to convert from trial to paid. Whatever is impacting, whatever the user actions, the things that actually have to happen in reality, in order to go from brand new user to upgrading out of a trial, that's what I would be trying to figure out, because those are what your growth levers really are. And then it's just a question of how do you create supporting interfaces or anything really to facilitate that. Could be blog posts, could be something like a lifecycle email campaign, all kinds of different options there. It really doesn't only have to be solved within the product, and certainly not all at once either.
Yeah, absolutely. That totally makes sense. That it's interesting though that you bring up things that are outside of, you know, the app experience, right? That there's in the same way that outcomes can exist outside of your app, and maybe your app is a small piece of helping somebody achieve that outcome. The experience that helps them get closer to the outcome can equally be outside of the product. There's one question that I want to ask you kind of a little selfishly, because it's a challenge that I am currently facing, and I think it's one that is certainly not unique to me, but is how do you think about onboarding? I sort of feel like I have a good handle on, you know, the things to think about when you're onboarding for something that, you know, let's go back to the invoicing tool and the 14-day trial where, you know, there's a good probability that the action that sort of is your measure of success will happen within that period, and hopefully more than once, right? Because, you know, building habits around your product is always a good thing if it's a habit that leads to successful outcomes. How do you think about onboarding for products that just aren't used that often, right? Or at least where the person who is buying the product, the person who is, I guess, sort of the administrator or the owner of the product is maybe not using it particularly frequently. how do you think about ensuring that they see success and they see value as quickly as possible if you know the actions don't necessarily fit in a timely fashion?
Sure. Well, boy, you know, that introduces maybe more questions for me to ask than answers that I could provide necessarily. But where my mind immediately goes there is, first of all, is the business model built in a way that acknowledges and aligns with that cadence of activity? If you're trying to, you know, have this hockey stick growth model and you've raised a ton of VC and your engagement, and like, let's say your retention is good, but your engagement is low because it's just not something that comes up a lot of times in someone's life, you're going to want to build a business model that accounts for that in a major way. You're not going to try to sweat what your like day three retention looks like, because maybe it's something that people don't use every 3 days, and you're just going to be trying to manufacture, you're just going to stress yourself and your users out trying to manufacture relevance where the relevance doesn't already exist in their lives. And so one thing I would say is just try to identify as much as you can the inherent nature of the value that somebody's looking for, and understand things like, you know, I mean, this might just be a too obvious example, but if you have a software that helps people file their taxes, you're going to have a much busier time of the year in the springtime than you will in the fall, in the winter. Like there will, or that the people who are coming to your software will be looking to solve like fundamentally different achievements or accomplishments than people who come at a different time of the year. And trying to, if you were creating a model of growth where you needed to be having people come back on a weekly basis, it would just not make sense for anybody who's involved in that whole dynamic. So I don't think that just because what might be relevant for giant corporate sort of Fortune 5 level tech companies doesn't mean that it's relevant for everyone. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a huge relief, because I don't think that hitting the kind of numbers that the tech giants want to / need to hit is necessarily even that healthy for the users of the experiences who are manufacturing all that engagement. So to my mind, if you're looking at something that isn't used very often, for me, I think a much more relevant question is, every time that situation arises in someone's life, you want to be the choice that they make for bringing resolution to it of whatever sort that they're looking to. But that doesn't mean that you need to introduce that situation into their lives on a daily basis either, you know?
Right, right. Yeah.
And so for like a more concrete example for me is whenever I travel, I will, whenever I'm in a situation where I'm trying to figure out where to go out to eat, especially in an unfamiliar area, I will turn to Yelp. I have Yelp on my phone, and you know, there's Yelp.com. Yelp owns the number one SEO ranking in my head for where do I go get food. And there are times like where I might go months without using Yelp, but it doesn't mean that it's because they've slipped off my radar. It might just be because I've gone a long time without really needing to think that hard about where I'm going to go out to eat. Or alternatively, there are times like if I'm traveling to Europe, and I am in a try to figure out where to go to out to eat type situation, Yelp doesn't necessarily help me out that much, because it might not be really that used in that location. And I'm just getting, reviews from other fellow American travelers who are talking about like good places to go get French fries that taste more like McDonald's or whatever. So like, you know, for me, like Yelp turns out to not be that valuable then, but it's not a question of like brand affinity or user loyalty or anything like that. It's just a question of, you know, are they the preferred way of addressing that particular situational concern within the context of that situation or not?
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense to me. And that's sort of leads into my final question here, which is, for somebody who is, you know, sort of whatever level they're at, and maybe there isn't a universal answer, but if somebody is looking to sort of improve the way that their product delivers value to their users, improve that sort of value delivery mechanism, what is the starting point? Like, where would you advise that they start? Where would you advise they go to look to start improving that system?
Sure. Is this kind of assuming that they're already working at a software company already, or that they might like just want to strike out in an entrepreneurial like sense?
Yeah, I mean, let's assume that they have a product already and maybe it matters whether it has users or not. It probably does. It probably changes the answer slightly. But yeah, let's assume that they already have a product with some users, and they're looking to improve how that product delivers value to those users. Where would you suggest they start?
Yeah, I guess I was about to say that I'm biased toward user onboarding, but I guess that's also not by accident, because I do think user onboarding is one of the best places to do focused customer research, because the concrete is still so wet with them, so to speak. Like, they're in the moment. They're not just a customer that's been on autopilot with you for 8 months and you're asking them to like speculate retrospectively what their value probably was or something like that. Like, you can really ask people right in the heat of the moment. From a customer development or user research standpoint, I love to just ask a really simple question to people after they signed up for anything. I do it even often on myself when I have the need or inclination to with user onboard itself. I have a newsletter that you can sign up for. Every day I get a list of the people who signed up for it the previous day. And it's really not that hard to just shoot an email to each person individually and say, hey, thanks a lot for signing up. Why is user onboarding on your mind? Like, what is causing this to be relevant, or why is this of interest to you right now? And that might sound like a really kind of high level conversational icebreaker type question, but it's really pretty much the biggest thing that I want to know, not just on a one-to-one basis with each individual user, but also to see what the patterns are across the user base overall. And so I would say, as much as I can generically extend my advice, that for anyone listening at home, so to speak, if you are working on a product, there are very few barriers at any decent software company to just getting access to a running list of the people who are signing up and just sending them a personal outreach email and asking them why X is on their mind. And the sort of answers that you get is just incredibly valuable as far as kind of doing passive aggregate customer development is concerned, but also just paying attention to the words that they use or how they describe their situations and use those as clues for areas to conduct further research in, or also to take those words and terms or turns of phrase and use that as marketing copy, et cetera. It's really something that can be applied across the board. Not to mention, of course, also that you're kicking things off in a really warm and hospitable way for each user that you reach out to. And a lot of times those individual relationships can also lead to a real dynamic of abundance, I guess you could say. So that would be one of my most tactical recommendations. And then if you do proceed to do that and can then begin to pick up on patterns and say, it seems like, you know, we have this invoicing software, and whenever we welcome people and ask them why invoices are on their mind, it's almost always because they just got their first client, or the person who handled invoices left the company, or because, I mean, I'm just making these off the top of my head. I don't build a business around this, but you know, you might see patterns around, or maybe they just lost their first deal because they were rejected because their business materials weren't professional enough. I don't know, but you will probably find patterns there to just the general contextual situational desires that people have. And then my recommendation would be to really think about how comprehensively helpful you can be. Just pick the most likely situation that you're picking up on, or the most frequently identified pattern, and just think about how you can curate an experience to just be a little bit in line or more in line with that particular aspiration that people have, and just be a little bit more helpful in that particular regard. And I would say, if I were investing my onboarding dollars in the highest impact, highest leverage, most growth-oriented capacity that I could, it would be basically along those lines, if that hadn't already been done pretty thoroughly beforehand at the company.
Great. Yeah, that's really really brings us back to the tactical stuff. We talked about a lot of different things, a lot of sort of conceptual stuff, a lot of sort of abstract ideas. This has been really awesome. I've learned a ton, which is great, and hopefully others will as well. To sort of wrap up here, where can folks find you online? Where can they connect with you if they want to hear more?
Yeah, everything right now still flows through useronboard.com. That's where you can go to find the aforementioned teardowns. And also, I wrote a book on user onboarding that's available there. And hopefully I will be sharing more and more materials around how to design for delivering value in the coming weeks and months as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Genuinely, was a real pleasure to get to chat about this.
Cool. Yeah, that's nice. As a wrap, I guess. this was a lot of fun. There is a lot to talk about here. I feel like we wandered all over the place a little bit, but there's so much sort of good stuff in every answer. It's interesting that it how much it challenges the status quo, I guess, which is interesting because I think the status quo is all relative to which company you're at, who you talk to.
Yeah, it was funny when you mentioned you like not knowing if I really even called myself a user experience designer. I don't know either. I mean, I really thought like I bought fully into user experience design and dedicated like a third of my life to it thus far. Like it's not something that like I sort of departed from easily. But at the same time, I did have a real, over the last couple of years, I guess I kind of popped my head up and thought that how I was practicing UX was representative of how UX was generally practiced or was supposed to be practiced. And as soon as I started comparing notes in a really concrete way with people, as far as just which tactics were being used and what was valued and things along those lines, I was just like, oh no, I don't think I fit into this at all. Like I thought I was, I thought I was a UXer, but all of the other UXers that I'm encountering are telling me that what I'm doing is not that. So I don't know. I mean, I honestly think that there are some huge holes in our current processes, and for user experience design to have really sort of established itself as kind of a status quo, or sort of I don't even know what the best way to put it is, but like it's very curious to me that in the whole history of user experience design, it would be hard to say that the last 5 years have not been the most important, and yet how much has the field really adapted that much over the last 5 years? What has really changed? I mean, I personally can think of things like lean startup, jobs to be done. Responsive design was a big deal, but that was like 8 years ago. I mean, maybe I'm just really out of touch, but I've been asking a lot of people and, just kind of putting it out there. Like, it seems like the time is nigh for some real advancements to be made, and people are like pull to refresh. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, are there things that you have been picking up on that you found really relevant? Because I'm certainly not trying to just dismiss it, but I just haven't really seen a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. It's sort of I mean, A, I was curious in terms of how you identify, but I find that I often find myself having a bit of an identity crisis myself because, like, I don't have any formal design background at all. Like, I have a business degree and got into growth sort of right out of, like, basically just, you know, learned by doing at an accelerator. And there was nobody on the team who was a designer. So, you know, we needed design stuff. So I did design stuff and then sort of started getting into, you know, jobs to be done and understanding how to actually make products valuable to users. And sort of that was sort of my path. And it was almost like a de facto, like, oh, well, design is a thing that we need to do. Like, you know, figuring out what it looks like and how it works is a thing that we need to do to get this product out there. So, like, I'll do it, but, like, wouldn't necessarily identify as a designer, kind of in the same way that I've actually found myself recently writing a lot of, like, front-end code. And I would certainly never identify as a developer, but, you know, I've got hired to do that and got hired to, like, design production products, right? And, like, but I don't really know, like, I always struggle to describe what I, like, actually am, if that makes sense. Like, I know what I do, but I don't know what that sort of makes me, right? Which is interesting because I feel like I've had experiences which are much closer to being, or well, certainly have been, you know, at that that table we keep talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But that a designer at the same company, or even, you know, somebody who just did things that are typical of a UX designer would not be at that table, right? Like, would not be having that conversation. Like, I don't even know how many sketch shortcuts I know, right? Like, that seems like the thing, like, you better be really efficient in Sketch if you're a UX designer, right? But, like, that doesn't seem, that's not at all important to the business, right? Like, that's kind of aligned with just making stuff that isn't valuable really fast. Right?
Like, yeah, or the fetishization of a particular workflow, even more so.
Right. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, truth be told, I literally have never even used Sketch. I have not opened that piece of software on any device I have ever owned ever. So, like, if that makes me not a UXer, then I guess.
Yeah. It's, man, but there is definitely a blog post with that title. I'm a UX designer who's never opened Sketch.
Yeah, well, and it was frustrating to me when I was just starting out in the industry. I was like, this is, I don't think that UX is, like, just supposed to be, like, a cooler version of visual design, you know, or like, right. It's not like, you know, it's like a souped up version of graphic design. Like, it is totally a different thing.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's ironic even for us to be saying that, like, we're not sure if we are UXers or not, and to be saying, you know, you feel more like you identify more with what you do than who you theoretically are. And, like, that's exactly what we're saying about how to treat users too. Like, don't put them into, it's infuriating to me when there's an onboarding experience and it's like, are you a developer, a marketer, or a designer? And, like, that's supposed to be, like, some sort of easy answer that people can just click on to help simplify the process in some way. Like, just ask people what they're trying to do, because anybody can be anything at any given time, and who they are doesn't predict what they want nearly as much as what they want does. So let's just focus on that.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point. Putting people in buckets is hard, and it's, you know, you're invariably wrong. If you, like, naming is hard, right? Like, so.
Yeah.
Trying to make decisions based on naming is is equally hard. Ron, but this has been really awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Customer Conversations podcast is brought to you by the team at LearnY. LearnY integrates with all of your customer-facing tools to organize feedback and extract actionable insights. Empower your team to start growing your bottom line today with insights from qualitative data powered by LearnY. You can find out more at either learny.co or by emailing our team at sales@learny.co. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Customer Conversations podcast. If you or someone you know has expertise in growth, marketing, or product, please have them reach out to either Sean or Stuart to learn more about becoming a guest on our show. Our team can be reached by email at support@learny.co.